This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are about to witness an evolution. On each episode, we will take a deep dive into the career of a legendary wrestling superstar, looking at all of the elements that led to and contributed to their long-term success, with your host, Andy Atherton.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the second episode of The Evolution Her and the Place of Nation Wrestling Feed. I am your host, Andy Acton, and thank you for joining me tonight. Tonight, we're going to break down the career of a legendary performer, and they honestly don't get more legendary than the person we're going to talk about. And you know what? My guest is legendary here at Place of Nation. He is the co-host of the Place to Be podcast, The Mothership. Also, over on the North-South Connection podcast feed that is still in its first month or two, he is the co-host of great shows such as Wrestling Warzone, No Holds Barred, The Extreme Three-Way Dance, and Jeff Learns Wrestling. Mr. JT Rosero. Justin, how are you tonight?
Oh, I am well, Andy. How are you?
I'm good, good. Thank you for joining me on the second, the sophomore effort of this brand new show. I had your PIC on the first episode where we talked about, you know, his true love, that is Mr. Levesque, Triple H. And tonight, though, you're here to talk about somebody who you grew up idolizing and love watching. So what famous legendary wrestler are we going to break down the career of tonight?
Well, I'll tell you one second, but I also tell you, can you believe it or not, North-South Connections in its third month now.
What? Wow.
Yeah, crazy, huh? It started at the very end of February, so. Time flies, my friend, when you're trapped in your house. but we're not talking in your house tonight, sadly, because this guy was gone by the time in your house kicked off. But tonight we're going to discuss the career of the Macho Man, Randy Savage, who is my favorite of all time. I was down to him and Kurt Angle for this show, but I feel like Macho Man would give us a little bit more meat to dive into. In full disclosure, I voted him number one when we did our WWE wrestler list a few years ago, and I was proud of it. I stand by my decision to have him at number one, and there's many reasons that we'll get into tonight why I have him there.
Oh, no, there's no arguments with that. I mean, I think he was at least top five for me. I think I put Shawn Michaels as number one, but yeah, Savage is one of my all-time favorites growing up. Just loved him so much. Was a lot larger than his physical size was. Mm-hmm. You know, he was such a presence, such a personality. He held his own with wrestlers of every sizes, just engaged as both a heel and a face. Better as a heel, I would think, but we can discuss all of that. So let's dive into the career of Mr. Macho Man Randy Savage. But he was actually born Randy Poffo in Columbus, Ohio. He was born on November 15th, 1952. And he was the eldest son of Judy and Angelo Poffo, was a wrestler. And he also was featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not for his ability to do sit-ups for hours on end. That's his father, his Angelo Poffo. His younger brother is also a professional wrestler, became one Lanny Poffo, and grew up in Zanesville, Ohio, and graduated from high school in Illinois. Later moved to Staten Island before moving to Lexington, Kentucky. He was an alumnus of Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. And then he was actually didn't start off to take over in the family business. He wanted to be a baseball player. He was signed by the St. Louis Cardinals organization as a catcher out of high school. He played in the minor leagues a little bit, mostly as an outfielder. He was in the Cardinals and the Reds farm systems. And then he also played on the Gulf Coast League Cardinals with Larry Herndon, who went on to be a major leaguer and a coach, I believe. And then, unfortunately, he injured his natural right throwing shoulder after a collision at home plate. He learned to throw with his left arm instead. And his final season as a baseball player was 1974 when he played for the Tampa Tarpons. Played 289 games in 404 minor league seasons, batting .254, 16 home runs, 129 RBIs. That's not bad for...
No. I mean, it tells you what the level of athlete he was, that he even got to that level in baseball, knowing what he'd be as a wrestler. So, not bad. Two sports star.
Yeah. There we go. And then, okay, so he broke into wrestling about 1973 during the fall and winter of the baseball offseason. His first wrestling character was the Spider, similar to Spider-Man. He took the ring name at the suggestion of a longtime friend and trainer, Terry the Goose Stevens, and Georgia Championship Wrestling booker, Ole Anderson, who said that the name Poffo did not fit with somebody who wrestled like a savage. The Macho Man nickname was developed after his was adopted after his mother, Judy Poffo, read a Reader's Digest article predicting that the phrase would become the next hot term. He eventually decided to end his baseball career and become a full-time wrestler, working with his father and his brother. He wrestled his first match against Midwest Territory wrestler Golden Boy Paul Christie. He then worked with his father and brother in Michigan, the Carolinas, Georgia, the Maritimes, and Eastern Tennessee Territory run by Nick Gulas. After a while, his father felt his sons were not getting the pushes they deserved, so he started the Outlaw International Championship Wrestling ICW promotion in the mid-American states. Eventually, it disbanded, and Randy and Lanny were entered the Memphis scene, joining Jerry Lawler's Continental Wrestling Association, which were the former competitors of the ICW. While there, he feuded with Lawler over the AWA Southern Heavyweight Championship, also teamed with Lanny to battle the Rock and Roll Express. Also, it included a match in June of 1984 in Memphis, where in the storyline, Savage injured Ricky Morton by pile driving him through the timekeeper's table, leading to the Express winning by disqualification, though Savage brother Lanny later said that Morton was not injured in the attack. Later in 84, Savage turned babyface and allied with Lawler against Jimmy Hart's First Family Alliance, only to turn heel on Lawler again in early 85 and resume the feud over the title. This ended when Lawler beat Savage in a Loser Leaves Town match on June 7th in Memphis, Tennessee. So, Justin, now you started, you're a little bit younger than me, so you started watching wrestling really in about 1990. Correct?
Yep, spring of 90, yeah.
And so you, a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about, at least for the beginning of the show, is all probably stuff you went back and watched. Now, have you gone back and watched any of the Memphis Savage stuff?
Yeah, I've seen some of it. I can't say I've seen his whole run or intimately knowledgeable about it, but I've definitely seen some of the bigger stuff. And my first exposure was to see if I can dig them up. There was like a 5 or 6 tape set I bought that had a bunch of Memphis footage on it from back in the day. And each tape had like a different focus. Like one had Savage on it. One had Bundy on the cover. They're pretty famous. They're like cartoon illustrations of the wrestlers on the front. And they have like 3 or 4 matches in the back. And I remember I was able to buy the whole set. So there is some Savage stuff I've seen on there. And yeah, I think most notable for him is that they ran that Outlaw promotion and really one of the earliest like invasion angles, right? was going on. Mm-hmm. They ended up turning it into an angle. And then they sold it and went into Memphis, like you said, worked for Lawler. And that's Savage's probably biggest feud on you know, his time in Memphis was with Jerry Lawler. And they're not there a ton of time. They end up going to, obviously jumping ship, and that's what we'll get into. But I can't say I've seen a ton of it, but I know a lot of it is looked at fondly, whether it's from the angle or the stuff with Lawler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I actually is on my my wrestling to-do list is revisiting some of the early stuff of some of these guys, especially Savage. I mean, because we're going to get into when he joins the WWF in June of 1985, he signed with Vince McMahon. And I remember this. Now, I had just started wrestling. I was, this is a little pre-night WrestleMania 2, which was really the pay-per-view that got me into wrestling as a, mm-hmm. I'm about this time, I'm about 12, 13 years old. And, I remember them billing him as a top free agent in pro wrestling. And his first appearance was on Tuesday Night Titans. And that was we're in the golden era of managers, including Bobby Heenan, Jimmy Hart, Freddie Blassie, all offering their services to Savage. He eventually declined their offer and chose Miss Elizabeth as his new manager. His gimmick was a crazed, evil, maniacal bully who mistreated Elizabeth and threatened anyone who even looked at her. So what do you think of this introduction? Do you think, because Savage, all-time great talker, didn't need a manager. But how do you think of this free agent thing? Was this the best way to bring him in?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought it made him seem like a big deal, made him seem coveted. They really hyped him up versus just like regular vignettes where a guy's introducing himself or they just kind of bring him in. This made it seem like he was a hot signing that everyone knew about, that this is a big pickup for them. And they're presenting him as a threat and a contender right away. He's not someone that's probably going to work his way up the ladder. He's someone that's going to get thrown right into things, as we'll see. And I agree with you. He didn't really need a manager. So putting him with Elizabeth made sense because they could, you know, he's a macho man, right? So the whole gimmick is that he's so macho that this, you know, he's going to treat this woman like shit, basically. And that's how they present it. So they tried to push it like she's the brains behind the presentation. He doesn't ever give her any of the credit and really just tells her to shut up and stand there and look pretty. A lot of this is actually chronicled if you are looking, if anyone is looking to like recap that part on the TNTs on the Dirty Network. They play this out. I remember we did the Excellent Network Adventure a few years ago. Mm-hmm. We went through those TNTs, so we watched it play out kind of week to week. So there is a lot of it covered in there in 85. And then, yeah, he pretty much gets right to it. Like his first MSG match, I was actually just looking at some of the stuff that Scott and I had done over the last few years. He fought Rick McGraw in June. And then by December, like he's in it. You know what I mean? He's like in the midst of everything. On Saturday Night Main, he fights Tito Santana. That's a big match. Then he's in the Wrestling Classic. He goes to the finals at the end of the year. And then he's fighting Hogan at the December 85 MSG show. And he's doing the Hulk Hogan shirt. So already he's like a top contender. And I think it's overlooked or forgotten because he, you know, if you just go at the pay-per-views, if you're not watching the TV or digging into the house show stuff, you're not going to really catch a lot of what they did in that feud. So if you're just thinking TV, you're thinking he went, or just pay-per-view, he debuted and then he shows up as champion at WrestleMania 2, right? I mean, that's pretty much it. I guess Wrestling Classic, but yeah. You almost totally overlook the Hogan feud. And they have a three-match series at MSG, and the peak was the January show, where I went 4 stars in that one as a Kelly Nelson. Scott went 4.5. But that three-match series really established him, even though he doesn't win the title, establishes him as a top threat to the world title. They're bloody. Those are great matches. I highly recommend anyone who hasn't seen them to find them if you can. Those three match years are great. And around that time is when he gets at the stuff with Steel because they fire up on the January Saturday Night's Main Event. They get going.
Yeah. So let's kind of just talk about, though, a little bit more about his characters, about his overall presentation. So what do you think of the use of Pomp and Circumstance as his music, which pretty much stayed his music during his entire WWF run?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a good choice. I thought it was inspired. It was epic. And it's funny because in the early years, they have it where they, you know, it plays all the way through. So you get like the weird part where he goes deep into the song. Dun,
dun, yes.
Dun, dun. And then they ended up, they trim it down later and they just kind of play the main part that, you know. But I mean, it was an inspired choice and they backed into one of the most iconic themes, pairing with a wrestler of all time. It fits him perfectly. He has plenty of pomp. He has plenty of circumstance. He's got everything. He's what you think of when you think of that song, to the point where even when you maybe heard it like a graduation, if you had any knowledge of wrestling, you're immediately thinking Macho Man. Like that's the excitement I got like graduating 8th grade from Catholic school. They played the song. Like that was a highlight. Like, oh my God, we get to come out to Macho
Man. You had a robot and everything. Right? You probably put your hands up and did the whole, you know, give me more kind of
thing. It was like a cross between the brothers, like the genius and Macho Man.
Yeah.
The Macho Man song with the genius outfit. But yeah. No, it was awesome. Like it was a perfect fit. The robes were perfect. And it, you know, it'll be a common thread as we talk about his entire career is the nuance and the minute details that he put into everything. And it's in his character, it's in his promos, it's in his feuds, right down to his gear. Like everything is tight, everything matches, everything, or if it doesn't match, it contrasts perfectly. He stood out, he looked different. Everything about him is precision. And that goes right down to what you've heard about him, right? Mm-hmm. Like he maniacally would plan matches out. He'd sit down and map it all out. Like he was OCD to that level. So that makes sense that every little touch, every little thing he does is this precise. So the music, the robes, Elizabeth's dresses, and it peaks, you know, we'll get to where it peaks, but it gets there eventually, right, where it just all comes together in one night of wonder. But it's all just really done excellently across the board with between the music and his look.
Yeah.
And not many people could pull off that ridiculous hair that he had. You know what I mean? Like, he's clearly gone bald. It's like the hair is wiry and there's no flow to it. It looks ridiculous, but it just works for him. Like, it doesn't look insane on him. It just looks like it fit. Like, he's one guy I cannot picture with any other type of hair.
Yeah. With the, he had the whole, the bandana look, yep, going. He had those sunglasses, which were very 80s at the time. Not a full robe, but it was more of a cloak, I guess when you call it, was out there, you know. But yeah, it worked because the way he would stand and just kind of feather out his arms. And just, he presented himself, like we said, he was larger than life. And the way he would, his finger, his hand motions, everything, the way he would just hold himself, and everything was very exact. Like every movement had a purpose that he did in that character. So, what do you think? Now, this drama, this era we're going through right now is the 85 to 87. When he was still kind of in, he was introduced, he was in the mid card. I mean, he kind of had the rocket ship strapped to him at one point, but you kind of got to take a step first. You got to walk before you can crawl. And he feuds with Tito and he wins the belt. And then he defends against George Animal Steel with that feud that a lot of people
kind
of. Never ending. A lot of people crap on because of George Steele's,
It just depends on how tolerant you are of George Steele. And to me, what always bothered me is, fine, I know some people, I think most legends like Johnny Sorrow and others, if you grew up in that era and you're a real big fan of him, fine. I think there is probably some level of affinity. But when you have a guy like Savage, it felt like he's, I don't want to say he's in his prime because I think his prime lasts a while, but he's prime era, right? He's probably at his athletic prime at this point in 86. He's so fast, so nimble, so quick, just amazing athleticism. And you're spending a year of his peak on, the biggest shows dealing with a guy that just can't do much besides gimmicky nonsense and comedy stuff. Damn. So watching all the MSG shit play out was nice because he does a lot more than that. He's embroiled with Tito. We get the Bruno stuff in here. So it's not, but on TV, it's so much Steel that it just feels like a bit of a waste. I'm counting him now. So he's on Saturday Night Main Event in January. They fight again at WrestleMania 2. They fight again January of 87 on Saturday Night Main Event. They fight again on March of 87 Saturday Night Main Event. Again in May. They had four Saturday Night Main Event matches. They never fight at MSG, and then they fight in the one pay-per-view. And then at WrestleMania 3, obviously, Steele is heavily involved in his match. Mm-hmm. So the feud, in all intents and purposes, lasts a year with four Saturday Night Main Event matches. That's a lot. That's more than we needed. So I feel like that was a bit of a waste. I still feel like they should have done Tito and Savage at 2. I think it would have helped that card a lot. Instead of Savage and Steel, you could have Steel and Savage in Tito's corner and get the same points across with him, with Liz and the flowers. And you add a nice quality match, give Tito his title rematch, or maybe even do the title change there. But whatever. If they want to do a Boston Garden, that's fine too. But I think it would have been a lot more. You also could have done, and I think Scott and I got into this, because they do end up spinning by the summer into that feud with Bruno, with him and Adonis teaming up against Bruno and Tito. They have a couple of matches, including a great one in the cage in July. Which they should have, I thought, carried over to the big event. Savage doesn't even work that event. So, again, there's a lot they could have done in 86 with him that we don't get to see because he's embroiled with Steel.
Yeah. So what was your – is Steel the signature feud, you think, whether you like it or not? Or is there in this time period,
I think you think Steel – if you really dove in, you might be thinking Hogan, right? Because he has that – that's 3 or 4 months, and he's doing shit on TV for that too, the Hulk who and calling him out. I think Steel, if you're thinking just if you're only watching pay-per-views and Saturday Night Main Events, you're probably thinking Steel's a big one. But if you're watching all the MSG stuff like Scott and I did, or you really know the year well, watching some other house show, or you're watching Prime, whatever's out there, you might think Tito for a lot of 86, because they were still feuding on and off around the circuit. So there's a lot of that there too. I'd say those are his big three. And the Hogan thing too, you see a lot of Hogan guys come in, they get the three matches out of the gate and then fade. That's what makes Savage so great. And the respect that they showed him is that even though he gets eaten up by Hogan, he has the three matches, Hogan vanquishes him and moves on, he's not done. He's not just shuttered to the mid-card for good. He's back soon up to the upper top. So they knew they had something in him beyond just a short-term contender for Hogan.
So what's your favorite match of this era of Randy Savage?
It would be that tag I mentioned in the cage. Tito and Bruno against Savage and Adonis. Again, a match I'd highly recommend checking out. It's really, really fun. They fight the month before in a street tag, which is really good too. I went 3 stars. But it's stuff with Tito at MSG is great too. I have 4 stars in their May 86 match. So if you're diving into Savage in this year, I recommend finding as much of the house show stuff from MSG as you can find. That includes the Hogan matches, the Tito stuff, and the tag. There's great stuff out there. It just wasn't widely available or provided.
And before we get to the next part of his career, this is something that's been talked about lately within, our chat groups and stuff like that. because we just passed WrestleMania season. What are your thoughts on the WrestleMania 3 match with Savage Steamboat? I'm not expecting you to give away where you put in your GWE televised match, but
yeah, I can.
Where do you put this? What are your general feelings on this?
So, and I can't give it away because actually I already did, because me and Aaron George have already given our whole full list away.
Okay.
The whole part.
So I'm trying to tell tales as skewel, as Tim would say.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. If anyone watched it, they would have seen it. So I can tell you on my list, I had a match of 22,
okay,
which I think is high. Like, I mean, you know, you got guys like Scott or others that really hold that match to the highest of standard. Honestly, like, it's great, but I do think there's flaws in there, and it's not just steel. Like, I don't think there's a ton of depth. It's a match that if you really put a lot of credit or stock into when it happened, it's going to hold up. But I think when you stack it up against, like, especially the ones I even have above it here, I just think those are worked better and tell a better story. And it's a great match. It's worked at an incredible pace, but it's just a ton of arm drags, a ton of near falls. It's funny. It's almost like the prototype NXT main event in a way, with a ton. This is without the finisher spam, right? But it's a ton of pin covers.
Yeah.
And I don't like the finish. I really don't. But beyond all that, I still recognize its importance, its place in history. I just can't rightfully have it higher than I do. And even that feels high. I also ranked, though, the Toronto match that they had on February 15th at Maple Leaf Gardens. That was 57th on my list. So that is one that is equally as good. I've seen people say it's just as good as Mania. I have it a little bit lower, probably just because of the atmosphere and the moment. But it's, from a pure work rate, it's probably right up there too.
Yeah, I mean, we just recently rewatched it during a group watch. And honestly, it has been a long time since I've seen that match. So, and I was one of those that held in high regard because, you know, like I said, I was a kid when I first saw it, and, you know, but after really seeing it now through a little more of an analysis brain, now, granted, I didn't do the list for this year. It would seem very overwhelming and daunting for me.
Well, you better start working on your WCW one. I don't want you to sit at home with nothing going on.
I'll talk to the boss about that. No, but I did the other two lists, the wrestler and the tag team. It's just the match thing is, anyway, so, but yes, I can see where people think it's overrated and it's overdone and it doesn't hold up as much. So I'm somewhere like, when I was a kid, probably 4 stars. Now it's probably down to like 3 for me, probably a little.
Oh, wow. Okay, see, that's pretty low. So to be in this spot on my list, it's, in theory, it's 4 3/4. Mm-hmm. I think I went 4.5 when mm-hmm. Scott and I did it on Place to Be, and that sparked a big argument, I believe. I just don't have it as a fight. Yeah, I had it 4.5, but we don't do quarters on that show.
Oh, I was talking about, mine was like a 4-star. I'm used to 4-star ratings at work. So, no, I mean, if we're going to a 5-star rating, yeah, I would probably have it at a 4.
You're the only human being in the world that rates wrestling on a 4-star scale.
Well, I don't rate wrestling ever, so.
Chad's not a 10, you're on a 4. That's where we're at.
Yeah, it's Andy's world. Try to do the math. So,
all right, so you have it as like a 4 if you're rating it like a real person.
And like a real somebody actually knows something. So that was his only, you know, he loses the belt at 3.
Well, so I want to backtrack one moment because mm-hmm. there's one match we did not talk about. Okay. That is well worth looking as well, and that is the November 86 Savage main event against Jake Roberts. It's a heel match and it's so much fun. It's a star, 3.5-star rating for me, but it's got an infamous story too. That the big wigs were at the Saturday Night event taping, Dick Ebersol, whoever was there, and they basically put them together so they could deliver a great match, and they put a lot of pressure on, like, you guys better go out there and tear it down, and they do. For a heel match that's worked as a heel match, that is just an awesome, one of my favorite Saturday Night event matches. So that's another Savage gem in 86 that maybe gets a bit overlooked if you're just thinking from a macro view. It's some of the steel stuff, but he has a lot of stuff littered in here. He even has a fun Pedro match at MSG as well, dragging it out of Pedro Morales in his final days. So a lot of good in 86 that shouldn't get discounted when you look at Savage's biography. One other one I'll call out, pre-3, is this the 6-man to set up 3? It's Savage, Harley, and Adonis versus Steamboat, JYD, and Piper at MSG in February, which is a lot of fun too. And that has Slick on commentary, which beefs it up even more.
I mean, I think I vaguely remember that. I was watching all the MSG shows growing up in New York. Yes, and heel versus heel was something you never saw back in those days on TV, at least. So he loses the belt, the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania 3. That was his only IC title run. Do you think he should add more, or was one enough for him?
No, I think he gets past it. Mm-hmm. And the IC title meant more at that time frame, but there still was a clean delineation between world title guys and IC title guys, and he's back in the world title picture really by the end of the year. He does continue to feud over the IC belt with Honky, and if you believe the rumors on the street at the time, he was supposed to regain that title at some point in 88. But I do think that they were ready. They saw more in him, and I think there was more in him. I can't think of a time where you could say, yeah, he should have had the IC title back. Because if you think of the line of IC mm-hmm. champions during when he's around, right? Yeah. It goes Honky, that's his last chance to maybe win it back. But then it goes Warrior, Mr. Perfect, they're not going to take his reign away. And then Tornado, fine, that's a blip, doesn't really count. And then it goes to Brett. And then it goes to who? Piper, mm-hmm. right? Back to Brett.
Then Davey,
Sean. Mm-hmm. Marty for blip, Sean, you know, so it's like,
yeah, he was way past that.
Which of those guys are you going to take it off? What reign do you, none of those guys deserve to have their reign taken away. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. It's a belt back then, at least meant for guys on the way up. Usually you don't go down, or once you get past that, you don't generally turn to go back. I mean,
all right, maybe something in 93, like if he has a little feud with Sean and mm-hmm. wins it for a minute, like instead of Marty, something like that could have been cool. But I don't see him as ever being someone again that should have been in a position to be like a long-term IC champ.
Yeah. All right. So as we said, he moves up the card at the end of like 87, and he wins the King of the Ring tournament, which, he didn't adapt the King gimmick though, right, at that time.
And no, then, no.
His character starts to change a little bit because mm-hmm. Honky Tonk Man is declaring himself the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time. So Savage starts a face turn.
And he basically said, you know, he didn't get his shot at Steamboat, never really got his title rematch. Now that Honky's champion, he's coming for his belt back. So yeah, he is prioritizing the IC title still in the stretch, and that indirectly starts to turn faces by hating on Honky. And then on Saturday Smith event, they have the big deal with the Hart Foundation and the guitar and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that really moment.
Yeah, where they throw Liz down and then Hogan makes a save and all that shit. So the Mega Powers, early Mega Powers before they really come together.
I mean, that was
that's just a tipping point, yeah.
Huge. That crowd went bananas when they saw, because Liz runs away, you know, and all of a sudden, and then she reappears and she's pulling Hogan, and Hogan's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And then he looks up and he just goes in and just cleans house with Savage. And the place is like, I'm watching on TV too. I mean, everybody lost their shit, basically, because these are two guys, like, arguably the two biggest stars in the company, probably, you would think, just coming together and being on the same side. So,
and elevate Savage a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he was kind of there anyway. Like, yeah. I think he could have been a world champ at this point. But it brings him up to Hogan's level, because they're treated as peers, they're treated as equals. Mm-hmm. And it makes them stand out as a big deal.
Yeah, and then they form the Mega Powers. And incidentally, though, also, something I didn't remember until I was doing a little research, that this happens the same night Hogan loses the belt to Andre in that.
Well, no, not the – so there's two.
Oh, there's two? Okay.
On Saturday's main event in October is the Hart Foundation.
Okay.
Right? I believe that's the one where they throw down Liz. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Mega Powers form.
Oh, it was the main event.
Yeah, the main event in 88 when Hogan loses is where Savage, I think, just like wins by DQ or whatever. And that's pretty much the end of their feud there. But the stuff with him throwing down Liz and the Hart Foundation, that's all in the fall.
Okay, yeah. That's kind of the wrong link.
No problem. That's kind of the end of for all intents and purposes, that's like the best Honky gets from there. After that feud with Savage, he really falls off a cliff, and we are tracking it, going through them. He has a really good match with Savage in September, another pretty good one in October, and then it's diminishing returns from there. And they never really hit that peak again. He also, a year to the show from the Jake Saturday Night's Main Event match, mm-hmm. he has another random one with Bret Hart in November of 87. That's also great. That's the only time they really ever have a big match. And which sucks. It's too bad they didn't have one later, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny. A year to the show, Saturday Night's Main Event in November, he's got those two just like random classics thrown in there. One with Jake and one with Bret Hart. But the Honky Feud goes all, you know, it goes for a while. It goes from September all the way to that main event that you mentioned. But it's definitely the September one that has the big angle behind it.
Yeah, which leads all the way to WrestleMania 4, which has the big tournament, because that, you know, the whole thing where the title gets held up because Andre has the whole screw job where Andre beats Hogan and surrenders the belt to DiBiase, and they tell him he can't do that, so there's no champion. So do you think Savage was always planned to win the belt? And the part B of the question is, but was this a way of also him getting the belt without having to go through Hogan yet?
I don't know if it was always a plan. There's so many stories out there around this, right? Part of the story is that DiBiase was supposed to win the tournament and Savage was supposed to win the IC title, but Honky wouldn't drop it. Or, you know, there's multiple stories floating out there. If you look at the original brackets, it was setting up for a Hogan DiBiase final, not a Savage DiBiase final. And then they revamped it afterwards. So I don't know if that was always the plan. I do know Hogan obviously was going to film No Holds Barred. So, you know, I think there's a chance the original plan was for DiBiase to win and then lose it to Hogan at SummerSlam. And they ended up calling it audible, which works well because it kicks off arguably the greatest storyline in company history from that point. From WrestleMania 4 to WrestleMania 5. And that was the show, you know, I was talking about earlier that really puts over the detail and just the awesomeness of his robes and the look and the attention to details with Elizabeth's dresses matching the robes and they change for every match. Like, he owns that show from top to bottom. It's a maligned show these days. I think it's fueled purely by nostalgia. It's a long show. You're not getting a ton of work right in there. But if you love that era and you watch it, it's fine. But otherwise, it's a tough one. But it's his night from start to finish. Like, he owns it. He's the man. He's presented as the man. And even though Hogan's there at the end with him, he's still walking out as the guy. And then he has a feud for a while with DiBiase from there throughout the summer of 88.
Yes. And then he, they basically really developed the mega powers as a unit. And they had their feud against the Mega Bucks, which happens at the first ever SummerSlam over in later that year. It was ref by Jesse Ventura, is also famous for Elizabeth jumping on the apron, taking her skirt off, which totally distracts Andre and DiBiase like they had never seen a woman in underwear before. So I thought that was kind of amazing.
Well, it's Liz, though. You don't see Liz in her underwear.
Right? No, you don't. Liz was like, you know, never... Well, they didn't have a lot of women that dressed that way back then, at least in the WWF. And then the whole thing ends with, you know, them winning and Liz on their shoulders. And, you know, they freeze the thing of Hogan's hand on her butt to start to create the tension between the two of them, which, you know, culminates, you know, later on that year at the Royal Rumble. Hogan is accidentally eliminated by Savage from the Rumble, which was, before they had the stipulation added to the... winner gets the title shot. And then on the main event too, Savage and Hogan took on the Twin Towers. We saw Elizabeth accidentally get injured and Hogan carries her to the back. Savage, the tension starts to culminate and Savage thinks he left them. And then he basically attacks him backstage and turns back to a heel and goes on to, attack Hogan and Brutus Beefcake, who tried to interfere. So what do you think of this heel turn though? Were you a big fan of it?
Yeah, I do want to back up just a minute to the summer. So he has a feud with DiBiase around the house show circuit into WrestleFest. And those are all really good matches. I feel like they never get the greats for some reason. They have one that's I thought was the best at MSG right before WrestleFest. But then I do want to call out just another match at MSG he has with Andre, which is unbelievably fun in September of 88. It's probably toward the tail of it where Andre could really move a little bit, but it's the aura and the presence of that match is unreal. It's so much fun. It's on my Savage recommendation list, him versus Andre, September 88. They have a rematch the next month. It's not as good, but that's a really fun one. Then they do Feinstein's main event. And then he has a little feud with Bad News Brown, which is cool too. That's where Bad News accuses, Elizabeth of doing favors for Jack Tunney to keep Bad News out of the title picture. But that's cool too, of note. And then we're into Mania. I think the heel turn was necessary to pay off the story. Mm-hmm. They've been burning this for so long that, you know, Savage is overprotective. He's jealous of Liz. Anyone that, you know, shows any sort of eyes toward her or any sort of machinations that they may be injured. Like he's, you know, goes maniacal, right? We saw George Steele, who's basically, you know, mentally handicapped, and he's beating the shit out of him because he's giving her flowers. So he's super overprotective of Liz. And in his mind, he's perceiving that not only is Hulk Hogan taking the credit for the mega powers, not only is Hulk Hogan want his title back and doesn't really, he's not happy for his friend, right? That's Savage's interpretation, mm-hmm. that he also wants this woman. And we do get these little moments in the storytelling that honestly, even though Savage goes heel, like you could interpret that story any way you want. You could be on Hogan's side or Savage's side in that thing, because there is enough there to make you think that Hogan was being a dick. Like he wasn't. These weren't all happy coincidences that he happens to be celebrating with Liz, or he happens to accidentally eliminate Savage in the Rumble, or he accidentally happens to put his hands on her, you know, like all that stuff. And Jesse's there, right? He's calling it out along the way. Something stinks. You know, there's more to meets the eye. You know, he's there calling it. He's on Team Savage. So there is enough throughout this storyline to make you feel like, you know, if you're Team Savage, that doesn't necessarily mean he's, you know, you're a heel in that situation.
No, it makes me laugh because when you talk about Hogan, you look back at a lot of Hogan's career and a lot of stuff he does should have been dick moves, like what he did to Sid at the Rumble, you know, by grabbing his arm and all that stuff and having Flair eliminate him. And
you could make a case from this point on, he's a heel. I mean, really, you could find enough wedged in through all this that he was running as a heel.
Just you present as a face, you know. But so then, you know, they feud and you know, Hogan's back from, you know, doing his movie, and they have WrestleMania 5.
Which is a great match. I mean, I think it's a tier below the really great Mania main events, mm-hmm. but they did great. They're really good with it. I mean, it's a hot match. Despite the crowd and the setting, they really go out there. Savage busts his ass to get Hogan over. You know, some out there, I think Dave Meltzer still stands by this, and others, I know Scott Keith has said it, that they feel that they could have been mileage to have Savage actually retain here by like a DQ and not lose the title and carry the feud throughout the whole summer with Hogan chasing and winning at SummerSlam. I've never been a big fan of that because I don't think that WrestleMania was at that point, but I do see the argument because mm-hmm. that feud was hot. And when you think about it, they had just turned. Hogan had just turned. Savage had just turned like a month before Mania or a month and a half. So you didn't really get a ton of legs out of them being at each other's throats with Hogan trying to get his belt back. He gets it back right away. Just the nature of the timing of everything. So you do wonder if there is another way they could have went around with it to let Savage continue to run hot as champion with Hogan chasing.
And then we get, and they bring in Zeus. Which I still don't get to this day.
They were trying to get the movie over.
Yeah, I understand that. But
they were trying to bleed that stone a little bit, get you to watch it, and then get you a pay-per-view at the end of the year. But they also work Beefcake in here, too, so they're trying to elevate him and transition some of the heat from Hogan to mm-hmm. Beefcake as far as Savage goes. So I think a big part of that tag feud was to get Beefcake up to a main event level, too.
Yeah, so and then so they have the Mega Maniacs versus... SummerSlam, which is backtrack for a second. So what happens is Savage ends up replacing Elizabeth mm-hmm. in April, and Elizabeth stays with Hogan, and then they place him with Sensational Sherry. What do you think of this pairing, though?
It's one that if you have any doubts about the greatness of it, you need to go back and rewatch the stuff from that year. Sherry is unbelievable in that role. And they complement each other so wonderfully in ways that if you didn't really study a lot of the match or look at a lot of the content for his manager, you would miss. Constantly interfering. They work flawlessly as a team. She works her ass off, bumps her ass off. She's just as much of the package as Savage is to that whole team mm-hmm. and unit. And I thought it was an awesome pairing. And she's wonderful in the role. They work together so well. They it's almost like they have a very... Just a connection where they don't even have to communicate, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And just kind of work together symbiotically. And it plays out over the next couple of years. So I thought it was a brilliant pairing. I think she's awesome in the role. As iconic as Savage and Liz are, I think Savage and Sherry are better as a package, honestly. That's how good she was in this run as a heel.
Well, yeah, because she actually could get physically involved besides just, you know, taking off her skirt.
she's a force in that run.
And she was a great, like, just that evil bitch that you don't fuck with. You know, you don't mess with Sherry because she's just damn crazy and she can legit kick your ass,
and she helps him a ton. I mm-hmm. mean, but in a way it doesn't make him look weak. It just works. And it's such a natural upgrade because what you just said is right. Liz didn't really do much, so they're kind of like, you know, I think he's like, well, I'm going to replace you with a better version of you, right? I think this chick is hot and she can get it done. Like, she can actually get involved and physically help me. And she's a badass and can handle herself. And I don't have to lock her in the closet and protect her. I'm not overly afraid because I know she can handle her shit. So, like, that connection from Liz to Sherry was well done, even if it was subtle and never really said.
Yeah. Yeah, she's not a distraction. No, she adds much more to his repertoire, so to speak, than Liz ever could or ever would. So he teams up with Zeus and they take on the Mega Maniacs in SummerSlam that year, and they actually lose due to Hogan hitting Zeus with Sherry's loaded purse. And then Savage and Zeus face Hogan and Beefcake in a rematch contested in a steel cage at No Holds Barred, and they lose again. So let's kind of pause there. Let's look at this era. This is the, we'll call it the Mega Maniacs era, I guess. Mm-hmm. What do you think? So Hogan obviously is the signature feud, you would say, of this time period. What's the best match, in your opinion?
So when are you starting? What's the benchmark time?
This is from so when he wins.
Four?
After, this starts with his feud with Honky. And then,
So from late 87 through SummerSlam 89, I mean, five is the easy answer. Like, that's probably the highest rated match I have. Him and DiBiase have one that I had at 4 stars in the summer. I'm trying to find it. Savage, like I mentioned, is great in September. Yeah, Savage DiBiase in June. I'd say those are probably the best. I mean, if you count the Brett match, obviously, but that's not really in storyline mode. It kind of is, because if you're Jimmy.
All right.
I would say, if you're looking for the best Savage DiBiase match to represent that feud, it's not four. It's June of 88 at MSG. The most fun match I watched was Savage Andre at MSG, and then Savage Hogan is the biggest one from that.
All right. Cool. And so so he moves on to he beats – so Axel Jim Duggan had beat Haku and was the current King of the Ring, which was not part of a tournament, he just beat him for the gimmick. And Savage ends up beating Jim Duggan and adopts the moniker The Macho King, which was awesome. and that, of course, that makes Sherry Sensational Queen Sherry now going forward. And he has a whole coronation, is led by his brother, the Genius, in which Ted DiBiase gives him a scepter as a gift. I remember them carrying him around, the two of them around the ring, and just all they kept doing was pointing at the scepter. It was like they had never received anything. Like,
it's such a good visual too of all the heels from that era. Like, if you're nostalgic for that late 89, early 90 era, like, all the top heels are in the ring for that coronation. It's so perfect. They're all just, you know, lauding him with praise and adoration.
Yes. And then on the main event three, Savage gets another shot at Hogan.
Just real quick. So he ends up feuding with Duggan all through that fall. And, you know, you could say maybe it feels like a downgrade, right? Because now he's kind of getting a goofy gimmick. He's feuding with Jim Duggan. I look at it more of as a break, because he still is a guy that can enter, and we'll see it. You're just about to talk about it at the main event. Mm-hmm. He can enter into a title picture at any time. He's not someone that is completely downgraded out of the picture. He's just doing something else. I know some people have issues with the King gimmick. They feel like maybe it was too goofy for him or beneath him, but I think he actually raised it up.
I think
he's the best, maybe outside like a Jerry Lawler, really, you know, to really ever take that gimmick and run with it and make it seem he took the gimmick up to his level. He didn't go down to the Goofy King gimmick. He owned it. He upped his game. We get the crown, the robe, and, you know, all that. He switches the tights in 90. You have him getting carried out in the sedan. Everything about him just made it even more regal. And this is the gimmick I knew when I first started watching. Like, he was just Macho King when I started watching.
Yeah.
I had to go back to one about Macho Man. But it's also around the times where he starts the Dusty Rhodes feud. And I didn't want to skip over the Rumble only because the Rumble match is fun. He's awesome in it. But they have the Brother Love show, which I highly recommend if you haven't seen it in a long time, where Brother Love has Sensational Queen Sherry and Sapphire on. And then Savage and Dusty end up coming out. We get a big brawl. But it's got the, you know, Brother Love, like, does he load you in the back of the pickup truck? And it's just such an iconic moment. And we're talking about Savage and Sherry, and I don't want to turn this to a Sherry pod, but her camaraderie with Brother Love is just as good as her camaraderie with Savage because they're like two gossip girls. You know what I mean? Like they're like bitchy and catty.
Yes.
And they even have one at MSG where they shit talk Liz the same way. And they just have this awesome, like mean girls vibe about them, her and Brother Love. So I wanted to touch on that because we'll get to six in the feud with Dusty, but that happens pre-main event. But main event's interesting because they put him right back in the title picture and he's credible. It's his, kind of his last title shot against Hogan, but he's a credible challenger to be elevated into what was supposed to be a massive night with Mike Tyson as the guest referee.
Yes. I think, though, going back to Sherry for one second, I think the whole King gimmick really elevated Sherry's persona,
yep.
I think, because she became the queen. And you didn't see a queen, really, back then. I mean, now we have Charlotte and all that. But, you know, she... We had the King gimmick because you had Harley Race and you had Haku and you had Duggan. But this really, you know, the first time that there was a... The King had a queen, basically.
Right. Moolah kind of did it a bit with Harley, but yeah. It was more of like a one-off here and there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, we haven't had an official queen.
And then, like you said, we're talking about the main event, which you covered not that long ago, actually, on the Place to Be podcast. And I remember getting together. It was Halloween, right? When we watched yep. the Buster Douglas Mike Tyson fight with Scott and Roger and Souza. And it was a fun time. You and I were really there just to insert little lines there because we're the non-boxing guys. But yeah, I remember this was a big deal because it was like shocking. You know, it shows like what kind of ripple effect Buster Douglas beating Tyson had because it was, you know, this was supposed to be the champ, like Mike Tyson jumping in there. This was the like equivalent of like if Rocky III was real. You know, with Thunder Lips and Rocky mm-hmm. fighting, that would be the equivalent, you know, to them. But then, so Buster Douglas comes in. The whole plan the whole time was, you know, Savage was going to get knocked out by whether it was Tyson or Buster Douglas. He was the one that was going to take the shot. But that was a fun match. And like you said, then he starts the Dusty feud, which was great because Dusty always was the common man and Savage was the king. So it made perfect sense. And also, you know, such the contrast between Sapphire and Sherry in terms of their body type and whatever, you know, really led to a lot of great moments there. And then he begins, then he has a match, then he gets all involved with Warrior right after. So do you have anything else to say about the Dusty feud before we move on to the Warrior?
Yeah, one last thing on the main event, too. Mm-hmm. Like, it tells you what they still thought of Savage. I mean, this is going to be a huge night. Mike Tyson, big ratings on NBC. And who do they give Hogan, you know, to carry that show? It was Randy Savage, right? Yeah. So they knew. Like, they needed a name. They needed a draw. And they go back to Savage. So they knew what the value he still brought. And the Dusty feud is a lot of fun for the first half. Mm-hmm. WrestleMania 6 is a fun match. You get the swerve of Liz coming back in the corner. You get Jesse just ripping Rhodes back at Savage. That's his guy. And through the summer, you don't see a ton. MSG was, you know, under reconstruction anyway. So I think around the circuit, obviously still going with Dusty, but you don't get a ton of action out of him. He does get dinged up. So he doesn't appear a ton during this stretch because he is hurt. I think it was his arm was hurt. So he has the blow off with Dusty at SummerSlam, which is nothing. It's really just a way to push together the DiBiase and Dusty pairing. And then they fight again at Saturday's main event, Oktoberfest again. Just a pawn in the DiBiase game, and it goes to Peter Winston's old theory, right? That DiBiase and Savage have this long-standing partnership. You mentioned the Scepter mm-hmm. Continues here, where they're constantly crossing paths and working together in one way or another. And yeah, then he does end up back with Warrior because Warrior's desperate for contenders. Like, he needed a heel challenger for the title, and who do we go back to? Back to Macho Man. He's mm-hmm. challenging Warrior as soon as the fall, and they're hyping it. He's demanding a title match. Warrior accepts, and then, you know, they fight on house shows, but then he says no at the Rumble, and Savage ends up costing the match to push their feud to hyperdrive. But it is around this time he's having the issues with Liz and his marriage, and wants to maybe have kids. He wants to get off the sauce, so it was around this time he started to shrink a bit. So he starts wearing the shirt with the pants, and it just seemed like he was done, like he was gonna ride off and call it and move into a commentator role. We can get into that in a minute. So this feud takes him through his first quote-unquote retirement.
Yeah, and so, yeah, like you said, at the Rumble, the Warrior was taking on Savage, and you know, Savage comes out and ends up costing him the match by whacking him over here with the I'm guessing a different scepter, not the same scepter, because you know it was it looked different, it broke apart, and I thought you know they would never use that actual one. And then you know, Savage failed to appear in the Royal Rumble, which led to speculation that that they had fled the building in order to avoid the Warrior. And that led to the a career-ending match at WrestleMania 7, which Savage does lose. And after the match, Savage attacks Sherry as he lays Dexter ring. And that was too much for Elizabeth, who was watching. And she rushed to Savage's aid, fighting off Sherry and reuniting with her one-time love to a huge crowd reception. Mm-hmm. And then that crowd pops. I mean, I remember watching it too. And it was like everybody was so happy. Like, I mean, Sherry was great, but you know, him and Liz had been apart for so long enough that it was great to see them get back together. And he, you know, loses the match, and now he's retired, and he has to stay in the WWF in a non-essential wrestling capacity. And then, of course, then, you know, about a year later, you know, Warrior is fired. And he actually wrestled a number of times, but they were mostly, you know, off TV, so that...
Yeah.
Yeah, so they kept the kayfabe going, and then he. So let's kind of pause right there. So this is the Macho King, and leads into his retirement match. What do you think his signature feud at this time? It's Dusty.
No, I think it's Warrior.
Oh, okay.
I think that match is just so big. I mean, it's, you know, we just did that tournament on my Twitter, right? So the greatest non-main event Mania match. I came in second, lost to Austin versus Brett. But many consider the you know, a top, I would say a worst top five WrestleMania match of all time, probably top three, along with Michaels Undertaker and Brett Austin, and maybe some of it a tick lower. But for me, I had a number three on my GWWE greatest match ever list. It's an awesome pathless play. It's insane at the same time with the Warrior talking to his hands and all that. The Elizabeth stuff is excellent, though. Well played. It brings your story to this dramatic, perfect close that started in 1985 with him looking down on her and treating her like shit. They split up because he's jealous and loses his mind, and then he realizes in his most moment of need who is there for him. It's Miss Elizabeth, and he holds the ropes open for her. You know, people are crying in the crowd. Like, and we'll talk about this later, I guess, but it's a thread for Savage's feuds, and this is why I've always loved him, and I think many love him, is the emotional aspect to the way the connection he has to the fans in his feuds. The emotion he brings out is really what makes him stand out as a wrestler.
Oh, yeah.
He just, everything means something. You get emotionally involved in his feuds. They're personal. Everything's personal to him. We haven't talked about one feud tonight that wasn't personal on some level with him, right? Of any matter. Like, he's had matches, but everything gets personal with him, whether it's, you know, Hogan trying to steal his girl, whether it's Steel making moves on Liz, whether it's Honky staking claim to being the greatest champion and then putting his hands on Liz, whether it's, you know, Dusty calling him out for being, you know, he's the common man and calling him out for being royalty and an asshole. Like, everything is brought, and we'll get more of him to come, but everything is personal with him. Everything gets to that next level, and this was the most personal of it all. He puts his career on the line and loses to the Ultimate Warrior and has to be forced into the commentating booth. And it's interesting because he actually starts his commentary. Everybody remembers it was a face, but the first month or so, he's a heel on commentary before he turns when he, you know, officially then proposes to Liz and they get married at SummerSlam, even though they're already married. They get married again in front of the crowd at MSG. And then, yeah.
Which I was in that crowd.
Well, there you go. You're going to see wedded bliss. And then, yeah, he gets pulled back into action because at the wedding reception, Jake the Snake and The Undertaker surprise him with a King Cobra in the box. And then Jake continues to taunt him, and Jake had been taunting and fucking with the Warrior, but then, like you said, a Warrior left, so they transitioned it to Savage. And eventually we do the angle where Jake gets the Cobra to bite Savage, and that triggers his reinstatement from Jack Tunney at Tuesday in Texas, which is just an unbelievable, not much of a match, but an unbelievable angle and moment that carry that match to greatness. Jake puts his hands on Liz, he slaps her, and beats the shit out of Savage, and the promos after are a masterclass in wrestling promos, again, purely driven by the emotional aspect of the feud. Here's another one just rooted in deep emotion with these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, you know, like I said, I was there. That was my first pay-per-view, and that it was tremendous when, you know, even the way he proposes, like, will you marry me? Like, yeah. The way he says it. It was always the way...
A bit.
Yeah, it's always the way he always knew the inflection where to get the most out of the crowd. And him and Jake, I mean, probably Jake is probably one of the greatest promos ever. And to put him and Savage together, that to me, I just every time I think back to Savage's career, that's probably one of my favorite Savage feuds, because Jake was just back to being evil Jake. Mm-hmm. and just Savage. Oh God, it was just tremendous. Throw the Undertaker in there, and it was great wrestling, great, you know, storytelling. It just had everything that you wanted. So you know, then he goes on to a feud with Ric Flair, who had come into WWF, and it was. Of course, they talk about being personal. It started by Flair claiming that he had been in a prior relationship with Elizabeth, going as far as presenting pictures of them together. It culminated in a title match at WrestleMania 8, where Savage won, and his second WWF championship. What do you think of the Flair feud when he came in?
So I feel like it's one that, well, just to put a bow on the Jake feud, so they're tearing each other in the Rumble, and then they had the blow-off at Saturday's Main Event. Mm-hmm. Kind of a disappointing finish to that feud in a bit, because they were still ready. By that point, they knew Savage had to get moved on, so they kind of hastily pushed through it. But fine, it's fitting. He gets to win. It was an awesome feud. The Savage stuff does feel, with Flair, does feel a bit rushed. They kind of back into the feud, mm-hmm. where Savage... It's not organic in a way, because Savage gets the title shot because Hogan steps down, and then we get into the feud versus the feud leading us to Savage getting a title shot, which ends up being fine because it ends up being so good that it makes up for it. Obviously, it was supposed to originally be Hogan Flair, and then they switch it up. But it's great. I mean, Flair just being, you know, classic Flair, right, with the mind games already. I had her before you had her. She was mine. They produced the pictures. It meant perfect. And just an awesome all-time classic at WrestleMania 8. Again, Andy, what's the theme, right? Emotion pouring through in this feud. Savage is just pissed. He's out of his mind. Wants Flair at any cost. And you wonder, like, is he going to win the title, or is he going to be so crazy he makes a mistake and fucks up and doesn't win it, which is on the table here because he's so angry at Flair. And he ends up winning it. And we get the great post-match where Bloody Flair kisses Liz to keep the heat going. Another iconic promo by Savage after the match where he's just super focused and angry. This summer's a little dormant. I don't know a ton of what goes on in there, but I know he fights IRS at some point.
Yeah.
Fights Shawn Michaels at some point. Mm-hmm. But that summer's very kind of dark in the WWF. There's not a ton going down. And then they you would think they do him Flair again at SummerSlam the way they keep it going, but they have him fight Warrior instead, which ends up being a great match too. And they do the whole thing, whose corner will Perfect be in, add some intrigue, and then he loses the title to Flair at a house show right after that. But it pays off because Flair injures his knee at SummerSlam, and then he preys on it in the match. So it's an interesting stretch. It's kind of a tale of, and it's kind of a coin flip, right, on which title reign is better for him. Mm-hmm. Because in 88, I think the title reign itself is better, but this one in 92 is more about him. 88, he still had the shadow of Hogan and the Mega Powers hanging over him, so I didn't feel like it was his promotion. In 92, it feels like he's the guy for that stretch. Like he owns a promotion from 8 to the end of the year. But sadly, we just don't get a ton of it. Like there's not a ton of it out there. He's working house shows. We get a couple of stuff. Like I said, get the match in Europe with Sean and all that. But there's not a ton of him as champion in that stretch to make you think like, okay, what a great run this was. It's more about him finally being the guy more than anything.
Yeah. And then once he, you know, he loses the belt, he ends up going into, you know, Monday Night Raw kicks off in January of 93. And he serves primarily as a color commentator, and he only wrestles occasionally. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, this is character time, you know, Doink, Repo Man, Crush. You know, then he goes on to the Royal Rumble, and he's the runner-up. A great final elimination. You know, that's where he goes, and for whatever
reason... You like it, where he tries to pin him?
Where he tries to pin Yokozuna, and Yokozuna just flings him from the pin over the top rope. I think it was a great elimination. Shouldn't have been the last elimination. It shouldn't have been Savage. Since I think you think Savage is smarter than that. But I just think all time, like, just the visual is great.
Yeah, but I do agree with the point here that we've heard a lot about, and it's kind of those what-if ones, is if Savage should have won that Rumble and fought Bret at Mania to put Bret over, it would have been an awesome match. It could have been a big, I don't call it a farewell for Savage, but probably his last big match in WWF. He deserved that shot. 92 was, you know, his year's champion. It kind of ends wonky, and Bret gets the belt. So I feel like there's so much more that could have been done with him to pass the torch in that moment. And you could delay the Yoko thing, and then you don't get stuck with the Hogan shit. And you just have Yoko win the belt at King of the Ring and let Bret run a little bit longer. I think it would have meant so much more in the long term to Bret to beat Savage at Mania, let Yoko build up a little bit more, maybe let him squash someone at Mania to keep getting over. Maybe it's Backlund or something, he goes over. And then you start his run off at King of the Ring like he basically does anyway, and you don't bother with Hogan for that few month stretch.
Yeah, I remember him. What'd you think of him as the color commentator with, you know, him and Vince and Rob Bartlett on when Raw first started?
Well, it is what it is. I mean, if you're a fan of Theater of the Absurd and enjoy the Rob Bartlett shit, more power to you. He kind of wears out his welcome quickly. But I was always a fan of Savage's commentator. I know he's it can be take it or leave it with him, but I really dig him. I love his enthusiasm. He always knew what was going on. He was very in tune with the product, put everything over strong. He was hyped. He understood how to get started. Like, he was just really good in the role. And him, JR, and Bobby is a great team at Mania and King of the Ring. They're really, really good in that role. So I thought he added a lot in the commentary booth. He became the guy, him and Vince, for the next, you know, couple of years for the most part. You know, he fades out a little bit with Lawler, kind of takes over more Raw, but he does do a bunch with Vince during the stretch, and that's kind of the team. And he was what Vince wanted him to be, right? You always hear he wanted the Babe Ruth. He was desperate for that Babe Ruth of WWF, the legendary figure that could be the ambassador, the goodwill. He was the face of the company, did the Slim Jim, did the Special Olympics, and he was a commentator. He could work matches here and there, but Savage just wanted more, right? He wanted more at that point than what Vince wanted to give him, which is too bad that they couldn't figure it out, a way to let him be more active and still keep that role. But I really liked him as a commentator. I thought he brought great gravitas, credibility in that role as a commentator. So I liked him in that role quite a bit.
Yeah, I also remember when the Crush feud started out of nowhere. I heard like they were doing like something. They were talking to Crush on the phone because he had been injured, and he said, "You know, I have something to say. Not once did you call me Savage. Not once." And I'm like watching this, and I'm like thinking, like, Crush and Randy Savage were best friends. What the fuck? Like, Crush was just pissed that he didn't send him a card or something. So after this period of time comes, you know, we have his final appearance. Is at SummerSlam.
No, he's on a Raw.
I was on a Raw.
He has a Crush feud, which I liked. I mean, you know, it was fine. They were friends, and Savage wants to get him over. And the Mania matches, as far as big final matches go, it's good. I think he fought after that a little bit, but mainly that's it. He's the host, but he's on Raw right up until he leaves in October. He's the commentator with Vince and whatnot. So
it's his master of ceremonies, it says here at SummerSlam. Yeah.
He's only in the beginning and the end pretty much of that show. he welcomes everyone in. He doesn't commentate or anything. It's Vince and Bobby. But he's a commentator on Raw still until he leaves, when Vince just shows up that night and is like, you know, he's out. We love him. We wish him the best. You know, Vince seems broken up when he says farewell to Savage on Raw that night. And it felt like a real end of an era in many ways. And as a kid, I was pissed, because I still felt WWF was my home promotion, and it felt like everyone was leaving. You know, he's going with Hogan. It was shitty. It just felt shitty for him to bail and go there. But it ends up being good for him, because he gets to extend his in-ring career for quite a while.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think his signature feud of this final stretch of his WWF run is?
It's Flair. Mm-hmm. No doubt. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to say the back end, like from the end of 92 through when he leaves, it's probably Crush. But the Flair stuff from... Jake and Flair are both up there, but Flair's probably the biggest one, because 8 is the biggest match.
All right. And then what do you think, what's your favorite match?
Flair at 8.
Mm-hmm. All right. So he leaves, like we said, he leaves WWF, and that's going to put a bow on this part of Randy Savage's career. And this is actually going to put a bow on the first half of this episode of Evolution. So when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the great Macho Man Randy Savage as he makes his way down south to that other wrestling organization known as WCW with JT Rosero. I am Andy Afton, so stick around. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back, Place to Be Nation, to episode 2 of The Evolution of the Macho Man, Randy Savage. I'm Andy Afton here with JT Rosero, and we're going to continue breaking down the career of the great one, Randy Savage. But first, let's kind of talk about what's going on here over on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Justin on the latest Place to Be podcast, episode number 548. Unbelievable. What a run you guys are continuing to have. You and Scott, welcome your guest Kevin Patak from Brother Sister. Rewatch over on the Jenny position. You guys talk about the MSG House Show from 10/19/90. Tremendous show. On the second episode of The Great Debate Wrestling, I was joined by Steve Willie, Jordan Duncan, and Chad Campbell. We broke down a variety of wrestling topics. And the big thing was we kind of talked about who the WWF missed the boat on the most, we think. Who would you say, Justin, off the top of your head? Who was some of the bigger... one of the biggest busts that they just missed the boat on?
CM Punk.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot of people, that's a lot of people's agreement. Chad went with Barry Windham, I believe. Scott and Dr. G are back with the newest episode of NWA Saturday Special, where they go back to April 2019 in Concord, New Hampshire. North Carolina, sorry, Concord, North Carolina, for the rebirth of the Crockett Cup. On episode 42 of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben is joined by Robert O'Neill to discuss his life of going to live wrestling shows. And don't forget to check out our other feed here, the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, with great shows that include a lot of my things, like the regular Great Debate, Laughing Theater, the Year in Pop, also the Glenn Butler podcast, Hour Spectacular, It Was a Thing on TV, and Marvel Age, and many, many more. Also, don't forget our good friends on associate feeds. First, Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position, which is home to Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Telling Stories, The Journey Through Infinity, which, Justin, you are on. You guys are up to, you're in phase two, correct?
Yeah, we just dropped Iron Man 3 a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have to. I think I still have to listen to that one. What did you think of Iron Man thing?
I liked it. I liked it the best of the three, I believe, based on my grade. I didn't have the preconceived issues with the Mandarin that many comics fans had. So for me, it was just kind of a guy.
I thought it was great, actually. I'm not a comics guy either, so I thought it was great. I thought it was more of a Tony Stark, though, than Iron Man movie. I mean, not saying that's
a bad thing. Oh, for sure. And that's why I liked it. I'm always a Mark for anything like Christmas-related, so I liked wearing the small town for Christmas and all that. No, there's a lot to like in that movie. And I'm enjoying the journey. Mm-hmm. I'm up to Endgame in my watching, so I just got to get to that at some
point. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Oh, the last 40 minutes of that movie. Man, just hold on to your seat.
Well, it's funny, because, as you know, I'm pretty well publicized how I watch these. I've been in bits and pieces, like while doing cardio. Mm-hmm. That got all thrown off the last 2 months because I wasn't going to the gym anymore. I got myself an elliptical here. So I got through Captain Marvel, which is where I had kind of left off. But I want to watch Endgame in one sitting, like on my big TV with a surround. I know I don't want to do that in pieces.
So no, it does not do it justice. Yeah. Trust me.
But the problem for me is finding, I know it's like 3 hours. So it's like finding 3 hours to sit at night. I mean, either my wife is watching TV with me or I'm doing podcast. I don't have just like a 3 hour stretch to chill. So, yes. So I'm either just going to have to do it like just commit to staying up late one night and just starting it like at 11. Or I mentioned to my wife, like maybe just, I know she's never seen like any of others. I'm like, whatever. Like, I don't think she's ever going to sit and watch them. So like, if we just watch that one night together, so I can just get it in. But I need to get to it. It's just on my list.
Yeah, oh no, you will. I mean, I honestly, not to spoil anything, but I literally went to see in the theater a second time just to see the last 40 minutes.
I've heard it's amazing. So I just, I just wanted to find the time. Like, I definitely want to do it right. I don't want to do it. Like, I could have been watching it in pieces, but I feel like it deserves the 70-inch with the surround and all that. So
there you go. Also, while we're promoting some of our associate feeds, we're going to talk about the North-South Connection, as brought to you by JT right here, and Chad Campbell and Aaron George. It's the official home of Wrestling Warzone, No Holds Barred, the Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jeff Learns Wrestling, the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, and much more. What's going on over there at the North-South Connection these days? What can people listen to that's up now?
So there's a lot. So we drop at least 4 shows a week. Usually, you know, every Monday, every Wednesday, every Thursday, every Saturday is generally a show. Sometimes on Tuesdays as well. Ruthless Aggressive, you mentioned, is a really fun show. So Jake Williams hosts that. He rotates his guests in. He's going through the Ruthless Aggression era. The most recent one that would have dropped as we record this was his second episode, where they look at the week after the draft. They started with the draft in March of 2002. So this is the week of April 1st, where Austin chooses to go to Raw. So it's a fun listening to Callum McDougall on as his guest there. Also, Aaron George has a couple of new shows that are really cool. I recommend checking out. One is called The Year That Was. So over the past few years of his life, Aaron has spent a lot of time watching every WWF pay-per-view, every WWE pay-per-view year. So he didn't do them in chronological order. What he would do is just kind of pick random years at a time through a randomizer. So he'd watch, say, all of 1998. Then he might have watched all of 2009. Then he might have watched all of 1989. And then he might have, so he just bounced around. And what he did was he took that, he kind of computed the ratings and his enjoyment. He put a scale together and he ranked the full years by his metrics. So he is now dropping individual podcasts. He's solo on them, talking about his experience in those years. So the first two have dropped, or the worst two. 1995 is the worst year, and 2010 is the second worst year. So that is an every other week show that drops on Wednesdays. It's basically Wednesdays with Aaron. I'm sorry, Mondays with Aaron, I should say. You either get that or you get From Montreal to Memphis, where him and his buddy Reg, I liken it to like a morning, Chad likes to say it's like a morning drive kind of show. So they just kind of rant on random subjects. The first one broke down the insanity of Vince McMahon. This last one was an homage to Sid. So it's kind of a fun topic, the quick listens. And so you get Aaron every Monday at the North-South Connection. Mm-hmm. And then every other Thursday, you either get the Wrestling War Zone. That's me and Chad. We just dropped Uncensored 96. The week that we're recording this, and we're getting toward WrestleMania 12, or Extreme Three Way Dance, or me, John, D'Amato, and Jenny are going through the history of ECW. We're into early 95, plus No Holds Barred, plus Chad Campbell's Carolina Dreaming, looking at the GWCW project, his Fighting Spirit of 06. We get so much cool content, and we try and keep it threaded. It's a lot of lists. It's a lot of deep dive. It's a lot of looking at the, as my old friend Parv would say, the edge of the cheese platter. You know, we're trying to avoid diving into the stuff that everyone's seen or known. We're trying to hit the forgotten stuff. So Chad and I are diving into those Raws and Nitros and looking for the stuff that may be overlooked or forgotten. Same with ECW, a time period that maybe not everyone has seen. We also have a new podcast dropping soon, too, that kind of follows along those lines. So, again, that's the thread. We try and go deep on this stuff. We try and keep it tight. We try and keep a similar feel to all the shows. So you can subscribe to us on any podcatcher app, mm-hmm. North-South Connection, facebook.com/North-South Connection. And if you are following us, just drop us a rating or leave a review on iTunes. And it helps us a lot, too. And spread the word. I think we have a lot of cool content. If you haven't checked it out yet, I'd ask you to do so.
And it's not just wrestling, right? You guys will drop, occasionally you'll drop a pod blast or a podcast here or there about some of your favorite non-wrestling subjects like Kirby Enthusiasm and stuff.
Yeah, we did a season, season 9 or 10, whatever they just finished. We did a recap of that season of Curb. Who the hell was on that? Was that D'Amato? Was he on there?
Yeah, I think D'Amato was on that show.
Don and... I think that might have been it. So that was a lot of fun. And yeah, we have some other stuff planned that may come to fruition as the weeks go on here. For now, it's mainly wrestling. But yeah, still, we're not limiting just to that.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Check it out. iTunes, Podbean. And yeah, we always support, you know, we're spreading the wings. And, you know, we hope the best for all of our feeds, our associate feeds, everybody. We're still one big family, Place to Be Nation. We're just kind of, you know, moving into different units of the apartment building, so to speak.
So yeah, trying to do some social distancing from each other.
Yes, we need the social distance. also, as Justin mentioned, we have officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have till New Year's Eve to do your research, promote matches, and build your list. There's a Facebook group on there, and there's the Pro Wrestling Message Boards. And don't forget, on the social media pages, Greatest Junk Food Tournament of All Time has begun. We're in round one in the Chips region. We're off to a great start. So I want to thank everybody who's participating. And just like a little quickie tournament, should go about a month or so, and then our big summer music tournament will come around. And don't forget to check out PlaysBNation.com each and every day. We have new voices, fresh takes, bringing you articles and topics of worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent's SmackDown Fox Report, This Week in WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Ben's Unpopular Opinion, In the Huddle with Hinkle, and much, much more. And don't forget, if you're doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the PlaysToBeNation homepage, or use PlaysToBeNation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps out PlaysToBeNation with no cost to you. So, back to the evolution of Macho Man Randy Savage. So where we left off, he had just left the WWF, and he, you know, had a lot left in the tank, as Justin did say, as we were going to break. And he shows up in WCW in December of 1994 on an episode of Saturday Night. They make reference to his love-hate relationship with Hogan and stated his desire to become the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. He later appears at Starrcade, saving Hogan from an attack by the Three Faces of Fear, and shakes hands with his friends and rival. At Super Brawl 5, he teamed up with Sting and took on Avalanche and Big Bubba Rogers, which they won. The following month at Uncensored, Savage wrestled Avalanche, with him getting the win by disqualification when a fan who just happened to be Ric Flair, dressed in drag, attacked Savage. This led to a feud between Savage and Flair, where Flair attacked Savage's father, Angelo Poffo, at Slammery, following a tag team main event where Savage and Hogan defeated Flair and Vader. So, Justin, what do you think of Savage's introduction in WCW?
It was kind of done weirdly, because he just kind of shows up on Saturday night and just in time for Starrcade, where he's out there. And then they ramp it up and they put him right back with Hogan, right? It's like they can't be apart. So they go right to the Mega Powers, where him and Hogan team up again. You mentioned it. And, you know, they feud with Vader and Flair and Arn. And it's fine. I mean, I think it's all pretty basic. He has some pretty good stuff in there. I don't think anything super stands out yet. I think it picks up for him in the spring when he gets into the feud with Flair and they kind of reignite the house show circuit for WCW. They do, you know, they draw really well and they have a really fun feud throughout there. They bring in Savage's dad, Angelo Poffo, at Slamboree. Flair attacks him, so they're fighting over that. That transitions to the Bash of the Beach, where he's fighting Flair in the lumberjack match, the lifeguard lumberjack match.
Yep.
And they do stuff with Baywatch and all that. So he's just kind of a top face alongside Hogan and Sting during this stretch. And I don't think he does anything that super stands out, but he doesn't. I mean, he's good. He's Savage again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he sells a ton and gets a bunch of wins, and he's great as always. And the stuff with Flair is really good. Like I said, it really carried their house show circuit, and you know, was probably the most entertaining piece of that stretch from a main event point of view.
Yeah. And then WCW debuts a new pay-per-view, and they put the WCW title up, and at World War III, Savage wins the WCW World Heavyweight Championship by winning the first ever 60-man three-ring battle royal, which, you know, I remember watching those. That is just absolute chaos, just trying to keep heads or tails of what the hell is going on in three rings with all those guys. He ends up only holding the title for a month, where she loses to Flair at Starrcade during the World Cup of Wrestling. And then he wins it back from Flair on an episode of Nitro in January. Then again, loses to Flair. Mm-hmm. So there's a little hot potato there with the title. And then he brings in Elizabeth later that January. But then she's the one that turns on him in his last title loss to Flair. And then, you know, gave him Flair, making it personal again, claimed that Elizabeth had given him a sizable amount of Savage's money, taken in their divorce settlement, and which Flair used to set up a VIP section at Nitro events. And then they continued to feud until June 96, when the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view happens. And that's when the famous Hulk Hogan heel turn, forming the New World Order with Hogan and Nash, where Hogan would turn on Savage and Sting and Luger, and Savage was actually the person who gets the brunt of it from Hogan in the ring. So let's kind of pause there for a second. So what did you think of the back and forth with the WCW title and then into the Hogan turn?
Well, he spends a lot of 95 after the Flair stuff into the Dungeon of Doom with... Yeah. So, you know, that is what it is, right? Chad and I have kind of talked about it ad nauseum. They fight at War Games, and him and Hogan are still pretty much on top. Luger comes in, and then we get the kind of love-hate between those four, Sting, Luger, Savage, and Hogan. They closed a bunch of Nitros with the four of them arguing. Savage keeps warning Hogan that he doesn't trust Luger or Sting or any of it, you know, and he's kind of the voice of reason. And we've talked about it. Hogan comes off as very fake and stilted through a lot of this, whereas mm-hmm. Savage feels very natural. He does win World War III, but he's got this long-standing arm injury. Luger beats him at Halloween Havoc by beating the shit out of the arm, and he's just dragging this busted arm all through the winter. And yeah, they hot potato the title a lot with him and Flair. They fight a ton. Chad and I have pretty much covered them all between pay-per-view, Clash, Nitro. So they fight a lot. They have a disappointingly basic match, a super brawl in the cage. Was hoping for a little bit more. And that's where Liz turns, which I thought worked well, because then it, you know, we can skip over because I'm not going to listen to my podcast on Uncensored, like Warzone, if you want to hear me rip about the, rip into the Tower of Doom. But then he gets back into a Flair feud a year later. And really for the third spring out of 4 years, there are 5 years, whatever, you know, 92, 95, 96, they're fighting in the spring. But this is another cool one because the angle is that Liz now has a chunk of Savage's money that she got in the divorce and she's given it to Flair. So we get this whole awesome angle where Flair is pimping around on Savage's money. They're sitting at a nice table in the aisle drinking and eating as Nitro's going on and just flaunting everything in Savage's face that they're using his money to do whatever they want. So a lot of cool stuff there. That's a really fun feud that takes you right up pretty much into the NWO debuting. I don't know anything stands out completely. Some of the Flair matches are good. Mm-hmm. You know, World War III is a cool moment, but I can't say like, oh, this is a must-see. From that stretch, I can check my ratings quick from Warzone.
Yeah, this was a crazy time, though. WCW was just throwing everything up against the wall, mm-hmm. you know, to see what was sticking. They were getting outlandish.
Well, and it's a ton of Hogan and Savage versus yeah. the Horsemen and the Dungeon. I mean, that's really what carries it. Once they siphon Sting and Luger into their own thing in 96, it's a lot of that. It's pretty much just him and Hogan fending off the Dungeon of Doom. You know, where he's fighting Arn, Flair, Sullivan, like all those guys. Him versus Flair on the Christmas Nitro in 95, mm-hmm. we marked as a hidden gem, 3.25. That's probably the highest match I have during the stretch with him as a singles anyway. He's got a fun him and Flair at 3.25 on the 122 Nitro as well. Him and Benoit on the February 5th Nitro is a fun one to check out. So there you go. Him and Flair again, 3.25, February 19th. They fight a ton. I mean, they must fight like almost 10 times during that stretch. So,
well, if there's a pairing that you could watch over and over, though, it's, you know, Savage and
yeah, and it's funny because they're always in the same role, right? Flair's the heel and Savage is the face, but they do it in different ways every time, mm-hmm. right? In 92, it's all about Flair saying he was with Liz before Savage and rubbing his face. Then 95, it's because he beats the shit out of his dad and pisses him off. And now Liz is in the middle of it again, but she's with Flair spending Savage's money. So they all have different slants on the feud. Mm-hmm.
So, and then leading up to the Best of Beach, you know, the whole, it was the Outsiders, the New World Order hadn't been exactly formed yet. You know, they had the big tag match, or actually it was a six-man match, and it was Luger, Sting, and Savage taking on Nash, Hall, and a mystery partner, which doesn't get revealed till later when, I believe is it Luger that gets taken out of the match early, or is it Sting? I keep trying to remember.
It's Luger, yeah.
Luger gets taken out and brought to the back. And you
right,
because
I think they were trying to tease that.
That one of them returning.
Man? Yeah, that he may come, well, that Luger may come back out with the NWO or something like that. You know? Yeah. I think they were trying to hint at that being possible.
Yeah, and then Hogan comes out and gets in the ring, and Savage is already down, and Hogan just goes and just leg drops Savage and pins him and wins the match and joins the, forms the NWO. And then Savage becomes one of the leaders of Team WCW, I guess you want to call it, and goes after Hogan for months. He's often attacked by the NWO, and then he finally faces him at Halloween Havoc for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship, but loses when the Giant interferes and hits him with a choke slam. And then he leaves WCW for a short period of time because he's unable to reach a deal with the company. So what do you think of the whole turn, though? With Hogan on Savage, do you think he was the right person for Hogan to do the leg drop on? Or you should.
Yeah, I mean, you could have done Sting because Sting is more of a WCW guy, you know. So if you're really going to stick it to WCW, but him doing it to Savage, I mean, he's always, as much as we've talked about how great Savage is and presented the way he is, mm-hmm. he's kind of always been Hogan's bitch in the end.
Yeah.
So it's fitting, I guess, in a way that Hogan pins him. But it didn't matter at that point. It was just about Hogan finally doing the turn. And Savage isn't first man up because Hogan's going to get the belt first, so you know, gets it from Giant. But then he's really the first man up to try and eradicate him after that at Havoc. And that's a pretty big match. Like, that's hyped well. It's built well. And Savage loses. They spray paint him and he vanishes. Like, that's kind of the end of his first run in WCW.
Yeah. All right. And so he returns in January on Nitro in 1997. And he hijacks the show, claiming to have been blackballed and refusing to leave the ring until Sting shows up. When the two left together...
I've been blackballed!
Yee! Savage appears again with Sting over the next few Nitros, roving and watching events from the crowd as quote-unquote free agents. At one point, WCW president and NWO member Eric Bischoff informed Savage that his WCW career was over. He can only return as an NWO member. Sting and Savage appear at Super Bowl 7, where Savage left Sting's side to join the NWO by helping Hogan defeat Roddy Piper. The next night, he reunited with Elizabeth, who had already been in the NWO. And then Savage began feuding with DDP and his wife Kimberly, with a long feud that lasts about 8 months, which includes tag team matches, no disqualification, a Spring Stampede, Falls Count Anywhere match, Las Vegas Death Match, a Halloween Havoc. So what do you think of him joining the NWO, which, you know, you knew was going to happen at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was. I think it was fine. It didn't surprise me because they started having everyone join the NWO, and he wasn't like a WCW guy anyway, mm-hmm. so it kind of made sense to him for him to be there. I thought they built it well with him and joining Sting up in the rafters and making you wonder, are they together? What's their goal? And then he officially joins, and he takes an alpha role pretty quick in the NWO. Mm-hmm. He's not a B guy, like he's an A guy with Hogan. And the DDP feud is excellent. It mm-hmm. elevates DDP to a main event player. Savage really gets him there. The stuff with Liz versus, you know, Savage was united with Liz. And the interesting with Liz, too, like, she was forced basically into indentured servitude with the NWO. But as soon as Savage turns and joins, she's, like, happy again and they're reunited. So you got Liz and Kimberly as part of the feud, which is really good. And that rages on. Like you said, they have 3 pay-per-view matches, all excellent, all really, really good stuff. And it gets Paige over in the end. And it was well worked. I dug it a lot. I think it's probably his best WCW year from a character and angle and match standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And then he starts a feud with Luger, which culminates in a match that's sold out of 1998. Then Luger also wins the rematch between the two at Super Bowl 8. When Hogan mm-hmm. failed to recapture his NWO title from Sting, it was Savage's turn. He got a shot at Spring Stampede. Hogan tried to make sure that Savage would not win because Hogan felt he was the only one in the NWO that should be the WCW heavyweight champion since he was the leader of the stable. With the help of Nash, however, Savage beat Sting for his 3rd WCW heavyweight championship despite tearing his ACL and his knee during the match. The following night on Nitro, Hogan faced Savage for the championship. It looked like Hogan had Savage beat, but for the 2nd consecutive night, Nash came to Savage's aid, powerbombing Hogan, but an interfering Bret Hart attacked Savage and preserved Hogan for victory. Savage then joined with Nash and others to form the NWO Wolfpack, a split from Hogan's group, and Savage went on to feud with both Hart and Piper. So what do you think of him going with the Wolfpack, getting kind of away from Hogan for a bit? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think he's good. I think he helped bring validity to the Wolfpack mm-hmm. with him and Nash. I thought it made sense. You know, I think he looked cool in the in the new colors, the red and black. And no, I thought he fit fine because he did have that cool vibe still, even for a guy that was older. Like mm-hmm. I feel like he still felt cool, so that was okay. The title stuff with Hogan sucked at this time. Like, he wins it, which is great, and then again Hogan fucks him. Like, the next night he loses to Hogan again. It's like he can't get away from him. That's the one thing that kind of mars his career, right? Is that Hogan's always there. Like the only time was 1992. Was it? Other than that, it's like Hogan's always there with him, which kind of stinks. And there is, I forget if it's a title change match or another one, there's a sick spot where Savage comes off the top with an axe handle and Hogan dodges him and he drills his jaw on the railing. Oof. It's just disgusting. But yeah, he ends up getting injured and with the knee and misses a little bit of time. And then he has that feud. It just feels a bit washed, the feud with him and Brett versus, no, what is it? Piper and mm-hmm. Savage versus Brett and Hogan. And yeah. Then they kind of split off. I don't know. It feels like a bit of a lost time for Savage. He's just kind of angry at Hogan and, you know, pushing along the Wolfpack stuff. And I don't think anything terribly, again, it's not a period I'm super up on, but I don't think it's like anything super that stands out big time for him from a career point of view during the stretch.
Yeah. And then, so
97 was, I mean, 97 is it by that after 97, we're on the downhill slope.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. He's a older, not over the hill, but you know, his skills are not down, there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speed is gone.
Yeah, injuries have taken over. And so in 99, he returns from his injuries, debuting a new look and a theme song. What up, Mach? Ooh, yeah!
Yeah, this is definitely like midlife crisis, yeah. Macho Man. So he comes back from the knee injury, and I'm guessing he knew that the knee injury was going to sap his speed because he overcompensates greatly. He's super bulked up. He's wicked jacked here. Clearly just roided up, gassed up big time. He's got the dyed hair, like the dyed slick back black hair. And he starts doing the Team Madness with the women. He's got his real-life girlfriend, Gorgeous George.
He's 23 at the time.
Jeez, for him. And that was like one of the first wrestling sex tapes that came out. I don't know if you remember that. She had made like basically a tape for him, mm-hmm. herself, taking care of business. It leaked. So that was out there in the early 2000s on the internet. I don't know if it's still out there now, but anyway. So it was her, Miss Madness, who went on to be Molly Holly, and I think Medusa was involved in that whole thing.
Yep.
And he gets back in the title feud, right? He's the ref, and then he's the shit with the Hummer and Nash. Like, he's kind of in there still. And then he gets hurt again, and I think he's, like, in a Battle Royal, like, his last appearance, pretty much.
Yeah. He interferes. He came back as a guest referee at Spring Stampede, which was won by DDP. He then interferes in DDP's matches to make sure that Paige keeps the championship. But when Kevin Nash wins at Slammery, Savage goes after it himself, and that's when Team Madness gets formed. Then at the Great American Bash, Sid Vicious returns and helps Savage to attack Kevin Nash. This led to a tag team match between Nash and Sting versus Savage and Sid, which whoever scored the pinfall would win the WCW Heavyweight Championship. Savage does win it, and is his final World Heavyweight Championship when he pins Nash. His last reign, it didn't last very long because he loses again. He loses the title to a returning Hulk Hogan the next night on Nitro.
No way.
Yes. And when Nash interfered, hit a powerbomb on Savage, and that is that when the NWO reforms, comes back together? Right?
I think it's around that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, but then he also just got the feud of Rodman. Yeah. They have a really fun match at Road Wild, which is pretty good. Yes. And that's it. I mean, so he disappears again after the Rodman, and he only has two more appearances. It's October on Nitro. He's in the ring, just does a promo. And then the May 3rd, 2000 Thunder, he joins the Millionaires Club, which is all the veterans, and helps them in a battle royal. And then he said he was going to help show the veterans take out the new blood, and then he never shows up again. So, I mean, the Rodman match is pretty much it for him, honestly, in WCW. So it is a quiet vanishing. And then beyond that, he doesn't do much else from a wrestling point of view. So we can talk about that, and we can talk about his final moments.
Yeah, I mean, he shows up in TNA in 2004 to 2005, but he's there for like maybe like a month. He makes his debut on Impact on November 19th, confronting the Kings of Wrestling, who were basically the outsiders. It was Nash and Hall. And at the end of the next week's show, he led a group attack on them. Then on December 5th, at Turning Point, he, Jeff Hardy, and AJ Styles defeated them all in a match. And then on December 8th, he leaves TNA, disagreeing with the finish of the proposed final resolution match for his Jarrett's NWA World Heavyweight Championship. So that kind of closes the book on Savage as a wrestler.
Yeah, it was cool, too, when he showed up there. I was like, okay, we'll get a little bit more Savage. Like, here we go. And it was so brief. It's really just weeks, like you said. But he definitely was a shell, too. He was still kind of juiced up. And, it was sad, kind of the later years for him. It was around this time, too. It might have been even before that. Post-WCW, pre-TNA. It seemed like maybe things were finally warming back up with him in the WWF. Mm-hmm. They did the whole Confidential episode on Elizabeth's death, where they pretty much blamed Luger for the whole thing. Savage didn't take much of a hit on that. And then they had the interview with him that's often overlooked in the SmackDown magazine, where they caught up kind of like, where is he now with Randy Savage? And that was kind of like the last mention of him for a long time. until eventually they do the DVD and everything and posthumously induct him into the Hall of Fame after he passes away in 2011. So it's, you know, it's sad that they never reconciled to the point where he could be back on WWF television before he passed away. He deserved to be enshrined while he was alive. He deserved to be on the Legends Raws and all this stuff. And it sucks that he never showed back up because of whatever issue they had. One of the few guys to never reconcile, whether it was because of the way Vince treated Angelo was part of the rumor, whether it was you know, the rumors between him and Stephanie that were recently popped back up in the news again, never ending rumors. Yes. I think Gorgeous George actually mentioned that Savage had told her that it was true. And speaking of, that video is out there. If you search Gorgeous George, porn, the video is still making the rounds. It's very late 90s. You can tell by the quality. But yeah, so that was it's sad he never made his return, but there is that lost SmackDown magazine interview. It's kind of the last time he was involved with them. Mm-hmm. And then, honestly, beyond that, it's Spider-Man, right? It's kind of his last big...
Well, yeah,
so I guess that was pre-TNA, but...
Mm-hmm. We can talk about him from a pop culture standpoint now. Everybody knows him. Like, I can't look at a Slim Jim and not think, have Savage's voice in my head.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Slim Jim is in the Junk Food Tournament, so I'm sure there's going to be lots of memes and GIFs, whatever, put when those matchups go up. But yeah, nobody can not know. Snap into a Slim Jim. Ooh,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With Hogan and probably Andre the Giant, he's probably a top three. If you pulled over anyone on the street and asked them to name some wrestlers, like, he's coming up in the first five, easy, probably the first three.
Yeah.
Everyone did, whether you were a wrestling fan or not, everyone did a Macho Man elbow, right?
Yeah.
Like, everyone did the voice. Everyone knew him. And then, yeah, the Spider-Man twist is great. Like, when he shows up there as Bonesaw, mm-hmm, early in the movie, the O2, first of the trilogy with Tobey Maguire, is kind of a great turn. And then, I guess, we can't leave out his rap CD, Be a Man Hulk. Hopefully, maybe he'll play that down the show or something. But him and Bryan Adams, his bodyguard for his rap career. Doesn't go very far, but he released an album with Be a Man as the title track.
Yeah, and he appeared on shows like Baywatch, Walker, Texas Ranger. He also appeared as himself in the 2000 movie Ready to Rumble, which was a horrible movie, which may get watched on Laughing Theater at some point. Who knows?
Well, we did it on PCB yeah, a few years ago. We did it for Halloween with Jenny and Tim and, mm-hmm, and Scott and I. So,
oh, I have a couple of guys in mind, though, that would really bring this to another level.
Let's do it.
Yeah. And he also, his voice gave him to, he did some voice work in some cartoons like Dexter's Laboratory, King of the Hill, Space Ghost Coast to Coast, and lots of other stuff. Yeah, just a guy that, you know, didn't do a lot of like acting crossover, like not like Hogan or Rock or Cena, but definitely had like the personality, the persona, you know, you knew him. Like, his distinct, ooh, yeah, all that stuff. Yep. Always one of my favorite characters to play in some of the old wrestling video games. I can't remember the off the top of my head. It was an arcade game where you would do singles or tag matches. But he was in it, Hogan, Warrior, Boss Man, Honky was in it. And that was my go-to tag team, and that was Boss Man and Savage.
Wait, so I'm sorry, which one were you talking about?
I'm trying to remember the name of the game. I think
whatever.
It was a wrestling video game. I mean, it was like an arcade game, though.
Superstars.
Was that Superstars? That was the
one. Well, it was Superstars and then WrestleFest were the two big ones. Yeah. Superstars was like, that was more like the 87-ish, mm-hmm, roster. You're probably thinking of WrestleFest if Boss Man was in it.
No.
That was
the biggest. No, Boss Man was in, and Honky was in this one, because I remember doing the Boss Man Slam in that one.
Boss Man was definitely in WrestleFest.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm.
But I think Honky, oh, maybe he was in both too. Superstars was the original one that they did, and then WrestleFest was the most popular one that was around. That's where they had Demolition and Legion of Doom.
It's Superstars. I'm definitely looking on the Wikipedia page right now.
Okay,
we had that was the first bowling one alley I worked in, so I played a lot.
And then WrestleFest was kind of the iconic one. It was in like every Aladdin's castle or not. I thought you were mentioning at first. There was a video game that came out in the late or mid 2000s. I think it was like Legends of Wrestling. Mm-hmm. My buddy Jim had it, and I think Savage was in that. Yeah, it came out in 01. Let me look at it really quick. Yeah, it had Hogan, Brett. It was a big deal. Like, they licensed all these guys out of nowhere. RVD, Funk, Snuka, Lawler. It was like all these random guys came in. Mm-hmm. And then they did a second one a year later that had even more names. Scott Steiner and others showed up in that one. Sid. So it was pretty cool. Like, they got individual licensing from guys. and released it. So it was a neat little quick series on PlayStation in the early 2000s.
Yeah. So talk about his personal life. Yes, he was married to Elizabeth. They were got married in 1984. They divorced in 1992. In May 2010, he married Barbara Lynn Payne, who was described as his high school sweetheart by Terry Funk. And then they said for years, Savage and Hogan were at odds and had on-again, off-again friendship, according to Jimmy Hart and Lanny Poffo. The two reconciled shortly before the Macho Man passed away, which did occur on May 20th of 2011. Mm-hmm. He was the age 58. And he suffered a sudden heart attack while in the car with his wife in Seminole, Florida. He became unresponsive and lost control of his Jeep Wrangler, crashing into a tree. It's terrible.
Yeah, and luckily his wife wasn't hurt.
Yeah.
Killed in the accident, which was good. And luckily he didn't drive into traffic or anything. Yeah. You know, kind of worked out. I mean, he was already dead before they hit the tree, but that it didn't cause any more damage than it did. And it was a sad ending. It was a tough day when he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely took it hard. Obviously, as we said, one of my favorites. And again, I think just to put a bow on it, you know, what made him great was that emotional connection to all the storylines we've talked about tonight, all the feuds and matches, always had that feel of realism to it. His promos, which we didn't really get into a ton of his classic promos. There's so many. I don't know if we could even touch them all. The mm-hmm. cream the crop and like all the cup of coffee, like all that stuff in the early years. And then the Jake promo, Tuesday in Texas, the Flair one, even the one we talked about, Survivor Series 92, where him and Perfect team up against Flair and Ramon. There's a great promo there. There's so much great promo work from him that we didn't really scratch the surface of. One of the all-time greats in that mm-hmm. regard. A guy that could go from yelling to quiet to yelling to quiet and make you listen. He was just a larger-than-life presence that brought emotion, brought realism, brought a great work rate, unbelievable speed in the ring, just worked so crisp. Everything felt real. Everything connected with the crowd. And, yeah, I think there's a reason everyone considers – I don't think – even if you don't consider him the best of all time, I haven't seen anyone that really out there really, like, discredits him or, like, doesn't like it. Like, most wrestlers you can find detractors. I haven't seen mm-hmm. too many Randy Savage detractors out there. And even for a guy that meticulously planned his matches, they were never really super formulaic either. There's a formula. Obviously, every wrestler has a formula, but mm-hmm. it's not, like, you know, in stone like many others. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, like we said, he's my favorite. Appreciate you letting me talk about him mm-hmm. tonight. And I'm glad he's remembered as finally as he is. He's finished very well. He ended up finishing number one, I think, in the GWA, so that was great.
Yeah, it was a great. Also, he's one of my all-time favorites as well. You hear the term when it comes to athletes, five-tool player, and I think Savage more than any wrestler. You know, he speed, power, you know, quickness, just the way he worked the matches, that the elbow drop, which, you know, at the end of the day, it's not the most devastating maneuver. I mean, you know, it's not as bad.
I don't know. Toward the end when he started really bulking up and
he would drive it in. I mean, it's not
the really
leg drop.
He really crushing guys in WCW with that fucking thing by the end.
And you do see tributes all the time to people using his move. I mean, Sasha Banks, CM Punk.
Jay Lethal.
I mean, lots of people. I mean, you can even, like, you know, make comparisons with Kairi Sane, who probably, you know, have everybody does probably the next best elbow drop. That insane elbow has some, you know, she drives that fucking elbow in. And just to, like, put a bow, though, like Justin said, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2015, inducted by Hogan. And, you know, it was long overdue. And it was sad that he wasn't able to do it. Because imagine his speech.
It would have been unbelievable.
Yes, and obviously most people, and this would be on yours, would be on most people's Mount Rushmore of wrestlers, I would think.
My personal one. I don't know if you could put him on the, if you're talking like pure wrestling history, Mount Rushmore. I don't think he's on that.
Well, maybe his era.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably talking like, you know, Austin, Hogan,
yeah,
Bruno, Andre, Flair, or something like that. You know, I mean, like you're talking top four of all time or something. Flair, I guess, is in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing that. That's a whole nother show. I mean, that's
we'll have
that's another topic for another day. But
maybe he's on my personal North-South connection.
He's on my personal top four.
I probably had him at least in top five. I think, if not number two, I think.
Obviously, I had him number one, so he's mine. Number one.
All right, awesome job. Thank you very much. But before we go, though, what's coming up on North-South Connection, as well as any other podcast you're appearing on these days?
Yeah, for North South, is this what I talked about earlier on a regular rotation? Like I said, Wrestling Warzone Uncensored just dropped recently. WrestleMania 12 is on the way. The new show should be coming out soon, probably not long after this hits. And then otherwise, a new place to be every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we had one, like you mentioned, with Kevin. Our next one will be Savari Series Showdown. So we're getting to Savari Series season. We're going to hit that. And then Savari Series with D'Amato. And Body Press Your Luck, Andy, which will be on the newest mm-hmm. episode. Can Ryan Everett be taken down? The competitors, the challengers. I think this is, what, episode 6?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's going for the 6, Pete.
All right. We'll see. No, that's a fun show to do. It's fun to prep. It's fun to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a quick listen. Anyone that's into wrestling trivia should definitely check that one out on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed.
Yes, yes.
And then Twitter at JT the Pod Guy, running tournaments there every day, wrestling-based tournaments. And on facebook.com/NorthSouthConnection.
Awesome. And like Justin said, I do. I am part of the crew on. Body Press Your Luck is a tremendous amount of fun. I mean, yes, just even the work going into building the shows is fun. It's great to do with you and Jordan and Chad helps out a little bit with keeping us honest. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and Chad waits till after the show, then bitches about what should have been done.
Yeah, like there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks.
No, well, that question should have been media. Mel, well, thanks for doing your job beforehand.
Well, you know, he's not like the fun police like other people that point stuff out after they've been published on the site, but we won't mention names. As for me, check me out on this feed. The latest, like I mentioned earlier, the latest Great Debate Wrestling with Chad, Steve, and Jordan. Tremendous time with three of the OGs of Place to Be Nation. And over on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, I'm always putting out episodes of Laughing Theater, it feels like. I do the two episodes proper a month. The last one before the current one, which was Animal House with Jairus and Neil D'Amato. Tons of fun. And the latest episode, arguably one of my favorites I've done, is with Peter Winston from Greens from Allentown. We watched The Goonies. And for Peter to actually look up international maritime salvage laws before getting on the show, that's a tremendous dedication to the craft. Also, don't forget to check out the newest episode of Year in Pop is coming very soon. We're going over 1982. That's with Scott, Dr. G, and just Mr. D'Amato, as well as a new episode of Pop Goes the Classics coming towards the end of the month. We're going to be talking about 1940s Dumbo. That's myself, Miranda, and Chad. So don't forget to check out all the great stuff on the feeds and on the Facebook page and the Greatest Junk Food Tournament. Justin, do you have any predictions or picks, favorites for this tournament that just started?
I haven't really studied the brackets yet, so I'll abstain. But Cool Ranch Doritos better make a run. That's all I know.
All right. Well, it looks like it's about to win its first round matchup pretty handily. So I look forward to
potato
that.
Potato skins in there? I know we get the Fridays ones, but the actual like potato skins in there?
No. We had to limit it to 32 per region or category.
Disgusting.
Yes, I know. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. You won't get that kind of stuff at North-South Connection tournaments. They'll include everything.
Damn right. Every single snack food you can think of.
That's right. All right. Awesome. So I want to say a big thank you once again to Mr. JT Rosero for joining me. And thank you, everybody out there, for listening. And we'll see you on the next episode of The Evolution. Take care, everybody.
Be a man, Hulk.
Ooh, yeah.